From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made when Rochester City Council meets to make a decision on what has become known as good cause eviction legislation. Could happen as early as tonight. 9 other cities in the state have opted into various forms of good cause legislation. There are different ways to do it, but generally, advocates will tell you that this is about making sure that tenants are not able to be evicted for no reason, and to make sure that tenants are not evicted just so a landlord or a property owner can raise rents by a severe percentage and find someone else who can pay it. And we have heard from the advocates. Earlier this month, my colleague Gino Finelli examined the case for good cause with some of those advocates, along with Rochester City Council member Kim Smith. One of our guests from that show, Liesl Coleman, is a spokesperson for the Citywide Tenant Union. And Coleman said that landlords who aren't evicting tenants for no reason and who are not trying to hike up rents more than 8.4% won't have to worry about this law. Coleman says they wouldn't be affected. The concern, according to advocates, is when tenants face 10, 20, 30% rent increases. Advocates call that unadulterated greed, unjust, unfair. As it turns out, many property owners have not been persuaded by these arguments. Matt Druin is the president of Freedom First Real Estate Investors Association, and he says that some of the public discourse has really missed what could happen here. And he was very pointed when he posted on social media about good cause legislation, saying that good cause is, quote, the Holocaust for naturally occurring affordable housing in our community, end quote. When tenant groups criticized Druin for invoking the mass murder of millions of Jews, he responded, quote, some of my friends were offended by my use of the word Holocaust and suggested I edit it. I'm not going to. I would rather defile myself by using disgusting language that offends people rather than see a policy get passed that creates homelessness and death, end quote. Some of the debate centers around exclusions for the law. The state's law has a guideline in which small landlords would be exempt from good cause legislation. So what is a small landlord? The definition can change from city to city. The state standard defines a small landlord as someone who owns 10 units or less. Data analysis from my colleague Gino Finelli indicates that that would exclude roughly 60% of Rochester units. Now, the city of Rochester says it's more like 36% of units. Meanwhile, the city of Ithaca lowered the small landlord standard to just 1 unit per owner. Rochester City Council has been considering their options. A couple of weeks ago, council released a report recommending they follow the standards set by cities like Ithaca, a much more expansive version of good cause eviction legislation. Before they decide, in the interest of fairness, we wanted to hear from those who are concerned about it. And as I said, we heard from advocates earlier this month. Now we welcome Matt Druin is with us in studio, president of Freedom First Real Estate Investors Association. Thank you for making the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me on and giving me a platform to apologize for that language that I used, because after some friends came on to me and was like, dude, what you said was really stupid. So I did issue a public apology for that, and I appreciate you letting me come on.
Well, we're going to set that part aside then, and we're going to talk about the substance of the issue,
yeah,
which we should be doing. Alex Castro is here as well, president and CEO of Pathstone Corporation. Thank you for being here. Orlando Ortiz, owner of Rock On Property Management. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And what category of property is that? This has been a big point of this discussion here. We're going to get into some of the nitty-gritty, but it's important for our listeners to know, our guests in studio, Orlando, what size property owner, what's the portfolio like? How many units here?
Yeah, so I manage a total portfolio of about 150 units, and they range from single residents to a portfolio of commercial properties as large as 33 units.
Okay,
so
Alex?
A little bit of everything.
Yep.
We have about 2,500 units, and all from high-rises, single homes, to communities.
Okay, Matt?
About 150 units of residential and also commercial property. It's probably 70% commercial, office, retail, and the rest of it's residential multifamily.
I want to talk about your concern about what is going to come out of this kind of legislation if it passes. And we still don't know exactly what council's going to do. They'll have to make a decision. Again, that could come tonight when they meet. We don't know. We'll see. But Matt, let me start with you here. You've been very vocal that this could cause a real hollowing out of middle-income options, mm-hmm. that this could cause more homelessness. How? Take me through that.
So I'm not so concerned of the actual rental increase provision that's in the proposed legislation, because most of us that own for-profit rental housing is that once a property is stabilized and we've actually put the capital improvements into a property, like the Rochester market cannot sustain more than, like, let's say 3 to 4% rent increases each year. Where the victims come about is in naturally occurring affordable housing, where you have slumlords essentially that operate cheap rental housing, and they're not operating under a business model that allows for revenue to go back into maintenance and capital improvements that this older housing stock desperately needs. So under the regime of good cause eviction, those housing units would get worse and worse until they become so untenable that they become boarded up and vacant. And we have boarded up and vacant housing in our city. It affects an entire neighborhood. So it has a cascading effect.
So make sure I understand exactly why. So the legislation, if passed, as I understand it, would say that the maximum increase in rent would be 8.4%, I think, something like that?
Between 7 and 10%. Okay. It's confusing as to how it applies with CPI, but, you know.
So somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying is, if someone wants to improve a property, they may need to increase rent more to help them cover the cost of making badly needed repairs, and now they're just going to say, fine, can't afford it, not going to improve it, and the conditions will deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate. Is that where you think it's going?
Exactly. That's exactly where it can go. And because we're talking about properties that need roofing, siding, windows, HVAC, we're not even talking about cosmetic needs of the inside of the actual property itself. And we're talking about some of these properties need $50,000 to $100,000 or more in desperately needed renovations to preserve that housing. So property owners like me cannot buy those types of housing units to do those repairs because it becomes unbankable. You know, we have to take these projects to banks to get bank financing on them. And if we lose the ability to actually increase rents to what we need to recover those capital improvements, then we just can't do the deal. And therefore, that housing remains in the hands of cash flow investors, which are the ones that we do not want in our city.
People who don't live in this city.
Primarily, there's some that live in the city. But, you know, if it's out of sight, out of mind, we've had definitely a pattern of out-of-state, out-of-country investors buying up cash flow properties in our city. And we've been seeing the housing stock degrade over that time. So,
and before I turn to your colleagues, one thing that advocates for good cause legislation will say is that, well, Matt Druin's only telling you part of the story, that there are predatory landlords who raise rents aggressively, who will throw people out and find somebody else who can pay them, who aren't improving their property and are doing all of this just out of, I knew the word they would use is unadulterated greed. That was the phrase we heard on this program earlier this month. And they said, you're only telling part of the story. What do you think?
There's two types of investors. There's local investors that actually, you know, want to operate housing where they have a good relationship with their tenants. And when the business model becomes so untenable that they can no longer have a sustainable business model, this is what we saw in the passing of the HSTPA 2019, the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, that a lot of local housing providers could not collect rent anymore, and so they sold their properties because the business model became so untenable. So we lost a lot of our locally owned housing stock to people that just don't know. And these aren't particularly intelligent investors that are buying up these properties. They see numbers on a spreadsheet, they see cheap housing, and they're like, what could possibly go wrong? And they're starting to see it right now in our community and how bad of a bet they placed.
Alex Castro, President and CEO of Pathstone Corporation. If good cause eviction legislation passes in the way that it's been described here in Rochester, what do you think happens?
Well, ultimately for us, we never get to make decisions locally about the rent increases. Well, we're an affordable housing nonprofit organization, so those rents are not decided by us. So that part doesn't have a significant impact, although I can say that the cost of operating rental housing, especially in the city of Rochester with aging infrastructure, continue to increase. So that plays a role into whether or not making decisions of whether or not to invest, right? Whether or not we're going to do a new affordable housing development. The part that really is impactful is ultimately, and I'm going to say, I view this through the lens of our residents, our neighbors, our staff. Ultimately, what happens is when we have a situation when there's a tenant causing trouble in a building through their actions, the only option that we have right now are two, which is either go to court for objectionable tenancy or wait for the lease to expire and then not renew the lease. This legislation eliminates the option of not having to renew the lease. So we can still go to court, but and as I've been doing this for 25 years, doing a whole an objectionable tenancy is almost like building a criminal case. You have to have evidence. You have to have witnesses. You have to have the neighbor be willing to testify. I don't know if that's the right term, in court. That's the same neighbor that has to go that same day back to the house. You have safety and concerns from the staff, you know, being verbally abused, threatened, et cetera. So our tools are very limited to work with those tenants that are good tenants when they face difficult challenges. What this does is makes it very difficult for us to remove that tenant that is causing problems. And instead, what happens is the good tenants end up leaving those units because they say that we're not doing anything. In fact, we are. Just we cannot share the confidentiality.
The good tenants leave because they're saying, hey, you've got an obvious problem tenant and you won't get rid of them. I don't want to be around this.
Correct. And it takes, you know, even if we go through the court process, we cannot share that with the rest of the tenants, right? Confidentiality. And sometimes it takes 6 to 8 months, best case scenario, to remove a tenant that is causing issues in the house.
Alex, I'm trying to channel what I think the advocates for this legislation might say. Mm-hmm. And I think some of what they might say is that it should not be impossible to evict a tenant, that there are tenants who, through their own actions, deserve to be evicted. However, homelessness is a traumatic thing for someone to experience. Eviction is a traumatic thing, and the bar should be very high. And that too often it is used too much like a weapon, too blithely, and that we should be very, very careful with getting to a point of eviction, that we should do everything we can to work it out before we get to that point. And so, yes, the bar is high, but it's not impossible, and that shouldn't be an unreasonable standard. What do you think?
You have to convince the neighbors that live next to those tenants day to day with safety concerns, not having their kids being able to go outside, having senior citizens not be able to walk outside. So I agree. The bar should be high, but I think it is incredibly high now. I think actually one of the things is I think we're missing a great opportunity in the city. I've been doing, like I said, housing for 25 years. Rarely you have both sides starting from the same point, which is safety and what works for the neighborhood. What happens is that we're looking at perhaps for every one case, I don't want to get into trading examples because that doesn't move us anywhere forward. What I'm saying is I think we have a critical opportunity here involving the courts and everybody in a room. We can definitely come up with a solution where this is just very extreme because it really what it creates is, and I've seen it many times, we take a resident to court for eviction. After 8 months, we lose. Now they actually are emboldened even more to continue their behavior. So it's fine when we're talking, you know, globally about homelessness, but I'm answering to those other residents that I have to explain to them that this person has to stay here, right?
And the other point that I want to make sure we are clear on is what Alex, who is the president and CEO of Pathstone Corporation, described is your options include going through that court process that you just described or waiting for that lease to end and then just saying we're not going to renew. But now you're saying with this legislation, that second option goes away.
Correct.
That you can't choose not to renew, that you'd have to give a reason. That simply saying, hey, your lease is up, we're not going to have you back, is not allowable anymore.
Correct.
And that's a problem for you.
It if you look at the timeline of going through the eviction process, so let's say that the court process is going to take 8 months, but the lease expires in 6 months. I'm going to still try to go through the eviction process. But if the eviction process takes the 8 months and in the 6 months the lease expires, now we have the tool to say we're not going to renew the lease for all these reasons, right, which are the same reasons that we're going through court. Now that will be eliminated, and we still have to wait for the court. And then if we lose the case because we didn't prove, you know, with evidence and with witnesses, whatever the court will require, then we lost that case.
Have you spoken to the president of council, Miguel Melendez, or other council members about your position on this?
Oh, yeah. I have to say they have done a great job going out, seeking feedback, interviewing folks, meeting with individuals. You know, I don't know that I have ever seen city council and city council president ever really looking so much into it. I think it's just more of a, you know, what I'm presenting is not a sexy, you know, it doesn't pull at the heartstrings, right? So I understand the pressure that city council and the president is under. But I think that this is a very extreme one. In fact, we can get everyone together, including the courts. Because remember, there is that option that we have. It's just that the process itself, the amount of money that it takes, what property owners, we have to become detectives, police departments, prosecutors, that process itself does not help. So if we were, and this is where we're missing the opportunity, to get everyone together and find a solution to solve that problem, but also not create an unintended consequence.
Orlando Ortiz, owner of Rock on Property Management, if this legislation passes, as we have heard it described, what do you think the result will be?
Well, I agree with what Alex is saying in regards to the courts. One of my biggest concerns is if we go to court for an objectionable tenancy, how are the courts going to be treating these cases? There's no clear law or regulation as to how will they proceed with the type of evidence that we need to collect and present to these courts. So we could be 6, 8, maybe longer months in this process. And in the meantime, tenants are nearby are suffering, you know, from the incidents that are occurring in a property. On a number of occasions, I've had similar instances where I've had a tenant that has been causing issues. We've called the police. I have cameras on site, provided evidence. And to the case, it just takes really, really long because there's no set proof or process as to what we need to provide a court to be able to get an eviction process. The tool that I've used is the non-renewal. So if the tenant only has 2 or 3 months, I just issue the non-renewal and the tenant moves out. If they don't move out, then you have holdover court, which that's another process that will still be allowed moving forward. In terms of like the repairs, I agree with Matt and the investment that won't be happening in these properties. You know, if we have a tenant that if we just acquired a property and you have a tenant that has been, you know, the rents might be really low. How can I, you know, go in and fix up a property without really justifying the rents that I really need to get to be able to justify those repairs? Over time, I might be able to do those. But, you know, I would want to make sure that the tenant that is staying there is living in good quality housing.
Do you think there is a problem? Do you agree with the diagnosis that there is a problem of too many people being evicted for either no good reason or because of overly aggressive rent increases? Do you think that is a current problem in the city?
Not as big as I think the ones that are for good cost eviction. I know I've been doing it for 13, 14 years. The folks that I associate myself with for the housing provider side of things, we don't experience that. So it's hard for me to relate to, you know, what's really, you know, what they're saying that's really happening out there. So for me, it's not a reality, but I can't say that that's true or not.
Let me encourage some feedback from listeners. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Rochester City Council will be making a decision on good cause eviction legislation. A number of other cities have already done this. City Council has, as you've heard our guest describe, taken their time in trying to put together a comprehensive report that was released earlier this month, and perhaps a plan that could pass council that would put the framework of good cause eviction legislation in place. Earlier this month, we heard from advocates, and now we are hearing from property owners, associations, management, who are concerned and who don't necessarily share that zeal to see this pass. So we're trying to explore multiple sides here, and let me get Lisa on the phone in Rochester first. Hello, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, first I got to say I've got tremendous respect for Alex Castro and for what Pathstone does as a subsidized housing provider. I'm just really surprised at the argument that you can't use the court process to evict people who are problem tenants. Because after leaving the federal court, I was a housing attorney for a legal services provider, and I saw this happen constantly. I seldom saw Pathstone there, but I saw people being evicted on a regular basis for being, for violating the terms of their lease, and that's what being a problem property renter is. Maybe it's crime or being unreasonably loud and disturbing the other tenants and things like that. You know, we all know that the eviction process was thrown into uproar during the COVID epidemic, and then the processes, you know, they were delayed for a while so that people weren't out on the street. They're doing their best to try to get themselves back together and reduce backlogs. But it's really surprising to me that your guests are arguing that they can't use the law as it's been set up to be used for decades and decades and decades, not since 2019, and they can't get other tenants and their own management to, you know, bring the evidence that's necessary. It seems like it's using the slowdown after the COVID and the courts trying to set back up and get orderly process as a, you know, an argument. It never took 8 months to get someone evicted if it was being diligently pursued. So I'm really wondering about that.
Okay, Lisa, thank you. Alex Castro from Pathstone, you want to address that?
Yeah, no, I never said that we cannot use it. I'm talking about the burden of using it. And, you know, we're in business. So if that's what we need to do, we will do it because it's part of the business. What I said earlier was that I'm taking it from the perspective of the residents that live there, the neighbors, the other residents. So we as a business, we understand that we have to go through that process, and we do go through that process. What I'm saying is that is it eliminates another tool. Listen, we're not necessarily going to be the ultimate ones paying the price. We're going to go through the process as we have always gone through. And she's right. We have always done that. But by eliminating that tool, what otherwise could have been a quicker process for those current residents is just going to now revert back to just the longer process anyways.
Okay. And Matt Turin, you want to jump in on that too? Lisa, hang there for a second. I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. But go ahead, Matt.
I just went through this process just recently, actually. I've been a resident of the city of Rochester for almost 20 years. And last year, we had a drug dealer that moved into one of the apartments that was owned by Providence Housing. And this individual was terrorizing our neighborhood. We had people that were ODing on my front porch, ODing in the sidewalk. There was two people that actually died on my street. One actually OD'd and died on my neighbor's front porch. I recorded all of the, you know, evidence for, you know, to help Providence evict this person due to objectionable tenancy, and they were not able to do so. And so their only tool was to get them out when their lease was up through a holdover proceeding. And so I had to live through that for about a year. So something's wrong with our process, for sure.
Lisa, you want to add anything there? I mean, I part of what I think I heard you saying at the end was you don't remember it taking as long as they're claiming it takes. Is that part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And when someone brought evidence, it's a summary proceeding in the eviction court. It's not the type of process that people are used to in, you know, divorces and other and almost any other case. It's you know, the judges are not inexperienced. They do know how to look at evidence. And so I'm really questioning, you know, if there is such a problem with the courts processing eviction cases where there is legitimate evidence, then your challenge is with how the court is implementing those or with your managers. It's not changing the law to make sure that, you know, we were talking about middle income people in the city of Rochester. I mean, we've got a median income here of less than $33,000. So when you're talking about a rent increase that you need to justify to do that, you know, we're actually turning it into, you know, student housing and other things like that, where you stuff a bunch of students. And regular people in my neighborhood are getting evicted, and then those are turning into short-term rentals and student housing. It's because that's the rent that people can afford. They can't raise it by $300 a month and expect somebody who lives in the city of Rochester to still be able to afford that rent.
Lisa, are you saying that, for example, that Alex, you think he is wrong about how long these proceedings are taking? Or
No, I think the length of time that would be 8 months would be only as a result of the slowdown after COVID. It wouldn't be a normal process. And if you look through the city court records, you would show that does not take that long to get an eviction, except after the you know, the terrible consequences of COVID.
Okay. Lisa, thank you for the phone call. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah. And again, remember, that's part of doing business. What I'm saying is, and I said earlier again, the rental issue doesn't apply to us. We're affordable housing. We're not increasing the rents, even for years, even before this law. We're very limited in our ability. We just cannot do that. What I'm talking about is the length of time that it takes. I'll go through it. I'm a business owner. Well, we're a nonprofit organization. We're not a business. So we understand that we'll go through it. It's our responsibility to the existing tenants. For us, let's say that is 3 months, 4 months. It's not eight. I still have to make sure that the tenants that are abiding by the lease have a safe and feel safe living in their units, that their kids can play outside, that the seniors don't feel like they cannot go outside. So cut that time in half. Make it 3 months, 4 months. It takes me 30 seconds to say it. Imagine living through that as a lower income individual on a daily basis. That's what I'm getting into. And like I said, the missed opportunity here is either way that it goes, we could get all of us together in a room.
Bob and Menden next on the phone. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Now, my brother and I own a handful of properties, and we've had to make some changes over the last 20 years. Some of them are downtown, and what we have found, one, there are the tenant has way more rights than the landlord does. And what we found happens is in situations of non-payment, obviously it's a breach of the lease. There's a whole bunch of things you need to do first to satisfy the court. You need to send letters, proof of that you sent the letters. You have to do them certified. All of these things take time. And then what we found is the court cases then get they're put on the books when you have all the information, and then the tenant will actually ask for that to be canceled and put another one in the future. By the time you're in court doing something, you're months into it. And for non-payment, we've lost well over $20,000 from people just abusing the situation. A lot of the people won't show up to court, so of course you get the default judgment. But then it's up to the landlord to go after that money. You have to find the people. A lot of times they move out of the city after doing this, so the court no longer has jurisdiction over them. So it can be a complete nightmare. So as a result, what we have ended up doing is we don't do one-year contracts anymore. We do everything is month to month, with the understanding that with a timely amount of time to let people know that you're not going to be renewing, we can at least get them out. Otherwise, we're stuck. They basically can stay as long as they're willing to postpone those court dates, and each month costs the landlord. So I'm not really that concerned about the increase in the rent monthly or every time you renew. The bigger thing is that the landlord simply does not have a lot of leverage. And if you go to a landlord court, you'll notice that the judge always seems to favor the tenant. So we have to run up against that as well. So I understand that there's landlords out there that don't take care of the tenants, but that brush shouldn't be applied to all the landlords out there. So, it can be a complete nightmare for landlords.
Bob, thank you for calling for a minute. So let me ask, on the subject of month-to-month, part of what Bob is saying is it's just more advantageous as a landlord to be month-to-month. Sounds like of course, if you own property, you want people who are paying. You want people who are going to be consistent. But he wants that lever as a chance to say, if this isn't working, we've got to be able to get out of it. Does this good cause eviction legislation, as it's sort of described, does it effectively end month-to-month, Matt? It kind of does, doesn't it? I mean, because you couldn't say, well, you're month-to-month, we're just not going to renew next month. Unless you went to court. So that would be a very significant change, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's been coined as lease for life. It would end month-to-month tenancy. I own property in high-income areas. I own properties in low-income areas. The low-income areas where I own, we have them all on month-to-month. In high-income areas, we have them on a one-year contract. And that's specifically by design, because we don't even go for eviction due to non-payment. If you look at the actual, and I'm interested in a study on this, of all of the spike in holdover evictions that have happened, how many of them are for non-payment, really, truly? And I think that most of them, if not all of them, are.
Orlando, are you on month-to-month at all?
For the most part, they're on year leases. I do have a few that are month to month, but they've just been really long term tenants, and we just kind of leave them that way. But I haven't switched over to the month to month.
Okay. By the way, we did get an email from a listener who just wanted to get a little clarity from Alex, just saying that, you know, Alex is describing tenant situations that sound like a war zone. Is it truly, how often are there safety incidents?
I mean, honestly, if I am the resident, one night or two nights or a week of what some of our residents describe is enough, right? It doesn't have to be a war zone. It has to be a quality
of
life.
What are they describing?
Kids not being able to go outside, play safe.
Because what's happening?
People coming in, going into the apartments. The tenants are having people coming over and leaving, you know, parties at night. Police being called. Drug sales, although that is, you know, very far in between. So it's just a sense of quality of life overall. Noises beyond 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. People hanging out in front of their doors, but they're really visiting their next door neighbor's door. You know, that quality of life incident. So is it true safety issues or is it perceived safety issues? At the end of the day, it impacts their experience living in our apartments and their quality of life.
I know we got to get a break, but let me grab Carrie and Victor because I think it's on this subject. Go ahead, Carrie.
Well, my question was, could the tenants anonymously or write letters about, I think that it sounds like just torture to be in a situation like that. And I didn't, at first I was all about the, I just think a lot more, I wasn't going to listen to this, but I did. And so now I'm just thinking, wow, what would it be like to be a tenant in that situation? And then I thought, okay, well, why can't they do this anonymously, talk to somebody anonymously so that their identities don't have to be out there for the guy? But then I thought about that. Maybe the person would know who, as they would say, snitched or ratted or whatever. You know, I don't know the wording. I'm old. But anyway, so that's my question is, number one, can it be anonymous? Like, you know, so that somebody swear or talks privately to the judge or something. So there you go. That's
okay.
My question.
Thank you, Carrie. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I'm not an attorney. I mean, any time that we encourage tenants to come and perhaps speak, we have really rarely, if not none, in my 25 years, relative to the numbers of these incidents, is still very uncomfortable. So to Orlando's point earlier, will the courts accept that? Is that some? So if you have some clear guidelines that, okay, if you submit three letters, even if they're anonymous, and the current resident that you're trying to evict never gets to know who they are, will that suffice? So that goes to that clarity, right? But that's where I'm saying getting everyone together in a room, including the courts, that's where you get those problems resolved. Right now is very polarized, either none or all or none. And ultimately, there's going to be some significant unintended consequences to that.
All right. We have to take this only break of the hour. And when we come back, we'll do so with you hearing Alex Castro, President and CEO of Pathstone Corporation. Matt Druin is President of Freedom First Real Estate Investors Association. Orlando Ortiz, owner of Rock On Property Management. Earlier this month, we listened to advocates of good cause eviction legislation that Rochester City Council could take up, could happen tonight, could take up this month. And there has been a recent report from council on that. Now you're hearing from those who are property managers, property owners, who have real concerns about what this law will lead to. So let's take that break. More of your feedback welcome at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, Monroe County legislator Susan Hughes Smith recently went to the UN climate talks. It was shortly after the national election, and she came back with a renewed idea about what local government needs to do about climate. We'll talk about it. In our second hour, organizations and individuals trying to uplift the community as we head for Thanksgiving. Talk to you Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So as I mentioned, advocates for good cause eviction legislation were on earlier this month. I want to listen to some of what they had to say and let our guests respond. You're going to hear member of Rochester City Council Kim Smith, who has been advocating for good cause, not only for good cause, but for the most expansive form of it, which council appears, based on the recent report, ready to adopt. And that would mean that you would define that exemption level property owner as someone with just one unit, essentially. So anybody with more than one unit would not be exempt. And so this New York State recommended 10 units as sort of that mid-size exemption. Anything over 10 units would not be exempt. But cities like Ithaca have said, nope, it's more than one, and you're no longer getting exempt. Rochester looks like they're going in that direction. Let's listen to some of what Councilmember Smith had to say.
We have a lot to make up for. And so now we are in a moment of opportunity where we can solve for a lot of those issues. And so we want to create the most inclusive piece of legislation that we possibly can. And so really attacking this from the standpoint of making good cause eviction eligible starting at one unit is what's going to work best for the residents of Rochester.
What kind of support do you think that has on council right now?
I'm not sure. What I am waiting for is the president's report to come out. So the president stated from the beginning that he wanted to put forth his due diligence and make sure he looked at this from a comprehensive perspective. The perspective of the tenant, the perspective of the landlord, the perspective of the administration. So he wanted to look at this from all angles. Now, I think the data speaks for itself. Looking at the increases, as I mentioned, in homelessness, the increases in eviction, and as the citywide tenant union continued to bring to our attention during Speak to Council, that just from July till now, 211 more eviction cases have entered. We would be remiss if we did not do this.
That is Kim Smith, member of Rochester City Council. What do you hear there, Matt Druin?
I mean, in terms of the report of one unit or more, I'm actually in support of that. If I was going to be in support of good cause eviction, which I'm not, the reason why is because why one through four units is what makes up the majority of our housing stock in Rochester. So why exclude that, you know, majority of residents from it? It would be passing good cause eviction just for its symbolism.
So you're saying if they're going to pass it, go for the full deal.
If they're going to pass it, which I do not support.
Which you do not support. but you're saying be honest about it. If you're going to do it, go for it. Even though ultimately you would like to see council decide not to pass it at all.
Yeah. I mean, in my recommendations, which it, you know, is probably not permissible through the law, is exempting five unit buildings or more, because that's considered commercial property in the city of Rochester. And really, we're able to finance desperately needed property repairs through what our projected income is on that property. So I think that that's where we should have the exemption, is on commercial properties, so that those property owners can actually finance those repairs through rent increases on those properties. And that's my thoughts on it.
Okay, Alex?
One of the things that I want to mention, we as a nonprofit organization, we're actually an advocacy organization. So that's our job, and that has been my job forever in housing, through foreclosure prevention, all those things. So one of the things that is important to learn, that is very difficult sometimes to look at the larger picture. And through time, that's what I keep saying, that's where the missed opportunity is. We're looking at this, you know, at the eviction statistics, but who's also speaking for those residents that are going through those difficult times? You know, they're unheard of, you know, the people, they don't hear from those folks. So that's where I'm coming from. From a business perspective, we'll figure it out, right? I mean, at least from the nonprofit, I may not have the same challenges as the private sector. My rents are always set. We have been doing this from day one when we started affordable housing. I don't think the market here can actually sustain at 10, 13% anyway. So I think you have heard that the rent increases is not really that significant of an issue. But the part of the unintended consequences, let's realize one of the things that we have learned, and if not, we should, that anytime we do something, some of the unintended consequences, the market will adjust, right? The market will find a way to adjust to it. And perhaps what may be a short-term solution becomes a longer-term problem for the overall neighborhood, just because the market will adjust to it.
So what should, before we turn to Orlando for his thoughts on what Councilmember Kim Smith said, what do you think should change to make sure tenants are protected fairly and property owners don't end up with what you described as unintended consequences?
So we as advocates and then, you know, the private landlords, along with the courts, right? If we're truly concerned about the quality of life of the residents of the neighborhood, we mean everybody, not just the ones that perhaps may be facing eviction. We're really talking about the entire community. If that's truly the concern, let's get us all in a room with the court, with the judges, to figure this out, a process. So again, City Council has done an amazing job, and President Melina, you know, going out and getting information. But if we all come together and say two things, this really comes down to two things, which is, how do we ensure that the people that get evicted don't get evicted because, you know, you're going to increase it, the rent by 10%, right? But also, how do you make sure that the people that are abiding by the lease, you don't cause disruption on their housing because they have to leave and they feel that they live in a safe and are enjoying the quality of housing. I'm sure we can come up with a solution, but we need the courts as part of those conversations.
Orlando, what did you hear from Councilmember Smith there?
Yeah, just similar to what Matt Drew mentioned. Obviously, I'm against this legislation, but I do agree that if it were to pass, that it should also include the, you know, the one to whatever landlords, not keep it at 10. I know in that conversation, she mentioned 211 evictions. I'd be curious to see how many of those are for non-payment or holdover or objectionable tenancies. Because, you know, you could throw numbers out there, but you kind of got to look at the data and see what would good cause eviction impact in that figure. And I would imagine that number is pretty low.
How much have rental costs really gone up, though? Because, you know, Matt, we keep hearing that, well, this market couldn't really sustain it, you know, realistically. We're not as concerned about that. But then we hear from tenant associations who say, you know, no, look at the numbers. I mean, look how much rental costs have gone up. Look how substantial it's been. They've gone up in tandem with holdover evictions. And, you know, just look at what HUD is saying, projected from 2020 to 2025, fair market rent up 48.3% for one bedroom, $775 up to $1,149. Alex, you got your hand up, so you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a larger market at play here, right? When we're talking about housing, let's not look at the bubble of the city of Rochester. When housing is increasing in outside of the city in other areas, it's putting pressure on those otherwise middle-income individuals that would otherwise, you know, move somewhere else. So because of the pressure on income, those individuals are moving to the lower markets. And those increases in the affordable housing side, not us, but, you know, in the private market for landlords, now there is a new population that is coming in. So what you're seeing in the price increases is not necessarily, some places could be greed or not, but it's because now there is a larger market in need of those more affordable rents. And, you know, that's just a market, you know, reaction. And again, to the advocate's point, I agree. You got to protect those folks that are lower income individuals because now they are in competition with higher income individuals that are able to pay a higher rent.
So two other points here. One concern over the years with regard to a term that not everyone even agrees what it is, but let's talk a little bit about gentrification, neighborhoods that change, neighborhoods that suddenly have a lot of homes that become flipped or, you know, attract investment. Let's say you've lived in a neighborhood for 40 years and all of a sudden prices are really pulling upwards and you're told, hey, you know, you're going to have to get on board with some of those changes or you're out. There have been some municipalities, and I don't have a ton of data in front of me. I don't want to speak out of school. Mostly what I hear are proposals that sound something like this. There should be a maximum increase if you've lived in a place for X amount of years that would protect you from, call it gentrification, neighborhood turnover, flips, et cetera, to allow you to not be, you know, in a situation where you're moving out just because after living there for 30, 40 years, now you can't afford it. Would you be in favor of laws like that, Matt?
No, I mean, because one thing is there's an open criticism, even in the affordable housing scheme that, I mean, Alex, you probably heard this before, is that affordable housing is not affordable, okay? Affordable for who is the question you get. And I think that, you know, to counter Councilmember Smith's position, we have an income problem in our city. Housing actually needs to be more expensive from a rental standpoint in order for us to improve housing quality stock. So I think that capping it, one thing is also on the gentrification standpoint, I mean, I've been investing in the South Wedge area for almost 10 years. South Wedge has been going through gentrification for 20 years. Gentrification is good, inclusive in gentrification. And I think that, you know, what we don't want to see is colonization, is what you see in the five boroughs throughout New York City.
Define that in your view?
Colonization is where you see a neighborhood flip in 1 to 2 years and all the residents get pushed out. This is a very, very slow process in the city of Rochester. From that person that's been there for 30 years, what can we do as a community to empower that individual to actually buy a home in that neighborhood, to actually have the power to decide what happens with that house and not have the be faced with somebody coming in and just jacking the rents up willy-nilly?
Okay. Can you explain, Matt, the process by which you think that the kind of the housing middle, that we'll have affordable housing, we'll have really expensive housing, but you said that big middle is going to get carved out here under good cause. Am I describing that your concern correctly?
Yeah, that's where we've been actually seeing it disappeared, and there's no supply coming online to address it.
So why do you think good cause is going to put more pressure and do more of that? What's going to happen?
Because the housing stock will degrade over time from those landlords that have owned the property for a long time, right? And typically, these cash flow investors, or they're also called slumlords, they don't put money back into the property. It's purely a cash flow vehicle, not a long-term wealth creation vehicle. So what we're doing is we're grooming investment capital to be attracted towards a business model that's cash flow oriented, not long-term wealth oriented, which is local housing providers that are responsible. And there's a lot of them that we lost since 2019. They actually reinvest back in their housing because they see it as a long-term investment, not a cash flow vehicle.
Okay. Let me read Dallas's point on how he sees some of the numbers here. He says, when you go to rent a house, and he's talking about if you own a house and you want to use it as a rental property, you need to set the rent at a level now that will let you replace the roof in a few years, replace the carpet, the appliances, furnace, air conditioners, banking the extra money. So make sure, let's say you charge enough rent to make $100 for you in a month, and then whatever 25 to 30 grand divided by, let's say, how many years to pay for maintenance, that you should be planning for this and that you should not be caught off guard by the need for maintenance and the cost of repairs. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, responsible housing providers, we take account into that. We take account for repairs and maintenance, capital improvements, major maintenance, and we actually set that money aside as reserves to invest in that in the future. Your cash flow investors, they don't care about that. They see what the rent is coming in. They're minimalists. They put a minimal amount of money into the property just to maintain a C of O, which is that's a totally different conversation. And that's the two dynamics you have within housing in our community. Does that make sense?
I'm trying to follow. I mean, I think people are hearing that, and certainly inflation affects everything. Inflation has affected the cost of repairs and supplies and materials. But I think some people are saying, look, you've got X amount of properties. Shouldn't you be able to, you know, figure out what your margins are and plan so that you're not having to jack up in double digits and kick people out if they can't afford it? Is that unfair?
So we're not talking about current owners. We're talking about a tired landlord that can't maintain the property anymore. I mean, this is a property I bought on Monroe and Meigs back probably about 6 years ago. Rents were like $300 to $400 a month. And this guy could not make money on the property, needed to sell it. So I came in, I was able to work with the tenants to relocate a few of them. But at the end of the day, the tenants couldn't afford to pay what I needed to put into the property. So it actually affects the transaction market with investors that are willing to invest to actually improve housing that are no longer going to be able to do so if you inhibit their ability to purchase the property and actually put those repairs into it.
Yeah, Matt's been clear about how concerned he is about this legislation. Orlando, as we get ready to close, about 30 seconds, how high of a priority should this be? How high of a concern is this for you? Could cause eviction legislation.
It definitely is a concern just because of the way, again, the courts are, they're just so vague if it passes on the objectionable tenancy side. I think, you know, the units, the count of units, the rent caps are all fine. It's just, how do we deal with those issues when they come about? And that's very unclear at the moment.
How do you see it, Alex? How high a priority?
If we solve the equation through what's better long-term for the overall neighborhood, for neighborhoods to improve, for neighborhoods to enrich, and people enjoy a quality of life, I think we're missing an opportunity.
Okay. And I'll close with an email. Sam says, changes in legislation are not likely to get to the deep systemic issues that produce these conditions. If an individual or family are struggling with generational deficits, they need mentors, caseworkers, counselors, job training, treatment, etc. Yeah, that's from Sam. There's a lot here, and I'm glad that our guests have been here for the hour. Listeners, I would encourage you, if you want to go back and listen to the Advocates case from earlier this month, you can listen to that program. And of course, you've been hearing from three people in this hour who have said to City Council, hey, just understand where we think this is going if we go down the road of good cause, which could happen as soon as tonight. We'll be reporting on that. WXXI will report on that if it passes or if it doesn't, or whatever council decides to do. Matt Druin, president of Freedom First Real Estate Investors Association, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Alex Castro, president and CEO of Pathstone Corporation, thank you, sir. And thank you to Orlando Ortiz, owner of Rock On Property Management. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.